ahead and call the meeting for, and do some introductions. First off, starting my right here.
Rebecca Shaw, member at large.
I am sure of Human Services Commission.
Mitchell Renner, Ward 2.
Tom Rose, Ward 5.
Russ Cassel, Ward 3.
Mike Fletcher, member at large.
Barbara Jefferson, Ward 1.
Jefferson.
Ward 1.
Tim Tenney, Community Development Department.
Jennifer Deaver, staff.
Molly Fair, city staff.
I would entertain a motion to approval of the agenda, for approval of the agenda.
I second. I agree. Motion made.
Second made.
I second.
Jefferson, second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Next up, we have approval of the minutes from our last meeting. I would entertain a motion for approval of the minutes.
Tom. Can I do a quick few housekeeping after that?
Yes.
Motion made for approval of previous minutes.
Second.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor, raise your right hand. Any opposed? Jennifer.
This is Jennifer Deaver, just a few housekeeping things. Just please remember that you are being audio recorded. We ask that you speak into the microphone and say your name when you're speaking for our person to be able to get good notes. And also, please remember that these are extremely sensitive microphones and they do pick up side conversations, so we want to make sure everyone's just aware of that. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Mike. Okay, we'll move on to old business. And for old business, we have the Housing and Community Development Needs Survey, which was approved. And then we all have a copy of that. And Steve, would you like to make some comments for that?
Yes, so we have, the survey was started to be, was operational out on February 8th. So just this past week, we already have 128 responses, so we're excited about that. We do have the survey currently is on the city's Be Heard site. It has also been sent to all the city employees, so that's a big group of people. And then also we are, it is being sent out with by the Columbia Housing Authority in their next mailer that they're sending out, that everyone will receive paper copies. We are currently waiting on getting back some boxes, but we will have, the survey will be at this, here at the city building again. Hard copies will be available at the Columbia Housing Authority, the Food Bank, Love Columbia, and we're hoping to also be at the library and the ARC. So we're excited. Some basic things that we've seen so far. All six wards are being, we've seen responses from all six wards, and these are just very, very preliminary findings. But all six wards have been, had responses. So far, the question one with the, what is the highest level of need? So far, we see preserving existing housing through comprehensive home rehab, minor home repairs and energy efficiency upgrades, and then also increasing home ownership through direct home buyer assistance and home buyer education, including assistance for down payments and closing costs. On the second question that we had on the survey, which was what community barriers do you have to these services or that you're experiencing?
No, the 1 to 9.
Oh, I'm sorry, the 1 to 9. So the next one is, the next question for 2, the highest level of need is providing vocational training for low and moderate income residents, which is HVAC, CNAs, heavy highway construction, things like that. Then also provide a city program that buys and removes abandoned and dilapidated houses used to rebuild affordable housing, and then build a new and improving existing neighborhood sewer drainage to eliminate stormwater flooding. So we're very excited that of our process so far, and we will be getting out as we at the next meeting. We'll have more updates for you all on where we are.
Did you get input or help from Joanne Nelson as far as distribution?
I will reach out.
And what about Randy Cole?
Randy Cole with the Columbia Housing Authority. He is mailing them out in his with their monthly newsletter, and then they'll also be available at their site, at their physical site as well.
Any further questions about the survey? I know they're available for us to hand out and print out.
If any of you would like, this is Jennifer again, if you would like copies of the survey to do that, please let me know. We can easily bring them to you and have them available for you as well, wherever you'd like them. And just so that everyone knows, we do have them available through May 10th is when we are closing the survey. And do be aware, any papers or surveys that are distributed or collected on paper responses will have to be entered by our staff. So we do ask that you give us a little bit of time to be able to get those in. Thank you.
Next, we will move on to new business, and that is information about the pre-application workshop.
This is Jennifer DeBriggan. So basically, we do have our pre-application workshop is scheduled for March 8th, 2023. This is an educational event that we do for potential applicants and organizations. The public and the commission members are welcome to attend. It's just basically us giving information about what the process is like and what everybody needs to do to get through.
I did see, I think it was a news release on that. Is there anything, how else are we able to contact people or put word out about this? I know we talked about this before and just the availability of the information. Is this going to go on the city's main website to let people know that this event is coming up? Or how are we marketing it?
It's on the calendar, on the city's calendar, and it will be, and the press release has been sent out. We'll also be posting it just like we do any other meeting that comes up. Are there other?
It will also go out on the city's, or sorry, our department's listserv for at least past applicants on that as well.
Are there any, does the city have like a Twitter feed or anything like that that it can go out on? You know, just I want to make sure that there's availability for people to know that this is happening.
Yes, Tim Teddy, Neighborhood Services does use social media, so we could ask them to just put a simple message in a Facebook post, for example, and then. I think we can use some of the other listservs that aren't necessarily designed for our customers, but might be of interest. An example would be a neighborhood association listserv. We also have a planning and development listserv that people subscribe to. We can use those. Our health department, social services division has been very helpful in the past, also helping us publicize things, so they could do that as well.
Ms. Jefferson.
Barbara Jefferson. Do you ever ask the TV stations to announce it also? I mean,
if they're receiving I'm sure that they're on the listserv to receive the press releases, so I'm not sure it's up to them whether they would pick up a story, but I don't know that has ever been done before. Okay, in the past, we can reach out and try to do that.
And is there ever anything printed in a newspaper? Or is there any material for people to put their eyes on to read?
Again, the press releases will go out to has gone out to all of them.
This is Tom Rosa, and then the choice of the press to decide what they want to print or not sometimes.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Diane.
Diane Tudor. You probably said this, but I missed it. What time of day is the meeting?
I did not mention that. It's at 6:30. It will be 6:30 to 8:30 that day. Mm-hmm.
currently it's in 1AB, but we will probably move it to chambers if the room is available. That's TBD. And that was Molly Fair, sorry.
Okay. Any other questions? Next, we'll move on to some special items. And so we had, there was an interest of having kind of a little workshop for our committee to kind of evaluate, reevaluate, reintroduce ourselves to our roles as a commission and some history behind that and related to the funding that that we are involved with making recommendations to the city council about. So Jennifer, you could kind of lead that for us in the discussion as well.
I can. So basically, with HDC's authorizing ordinance and the board and staff member roles, the HDC board members, their role is to assist in engaging the public to identify priorities, review data, plans, performance proposals, making funding and policy recommendations to the city council, and to conduct the public meetings and obtain citizen feedback. The board is accountable to the city council and to low and to moderate income populations. The value that's added there is providing public perspectives from respective experiences. They're the eyes and the ears of the city council, and also to assist staff in promoting programs and engaging the community. The city staff's role is to provide staff support, knowledge, and expertise to the commission, provide funding, regulatory, and project updates, to communicate high priorities and areas of concern, and to oversee daily operation and implementation of programs, promoting programs and initiatives, reporting to HUD, budget management, contract management, drawing of funds, and regulatory compliance. The city staff is accountable to the policies and ordinances of the adopted by that have been adopted by the collective city council, the city manager, the department director, HUD, and to LMI populations. The value that's added there is understanding of rules and regulations, understanding of council policy and community needs, connected to diverse level of stakeholders, both internal and external, and understands processes and procedures for implementing the projects.
Has the commission ever made any, this Tom Rose, has the commission ever made any policy recommendations that you're aware of?
I would say one example, Tim Teddy, and I would say one example would be when you review the policy resolution and you advise council on possible changes to that. I'm speaking of the guidance that we follow in what percentage of dollars we allocate to different types of activities. So that would be one example. And then I think a further example would be when we do the plan making, which we get into more seriously with the five-year cycle of the consolidated plan, that would be in the form of policy advice, because you'd be acting on a plan that then goes to council that says, over a five-year period, here are the priorities for the use of these federal funds and the strategies that we want to employ.
Tom Rose again, will you be reviewing that cycle for the plan, the five-year plan? I don't know if you're going to cover that, but you might cover that again. Where we are in that process, so what that will be about.
We haven't yet started the consolidated plan. That'll be an activity, though, that we'll do next year, because We're going to be entering our last program year here with the 24 funding. So we're going to want, actually towards the end of this year, we'll want to give you a schedule for that. I don't think we're prepared to talk about it tonight, except in very general terms.
Just knowing that at the end of 23.
Yeah.
Is 23 the last year, but nor was it 24 the last year.
24 is the last program year of the five-year plan. So what happens is we will build together and with the community and adding a lot more meetings than just our annual needs hearing. We'll build a plan for the next 5 years, and that first year, 2025 program year, that'll be considered the 2025 action plan, as well as a chapter of the five-year plan. So.
Yes,
Just looking at the roles of the city staff, so knowledge and expertise to the commission. I myself, this is only going to be my second year of rating the presentations that we see, and I want to kind of emphasize how much I lean on city staff for the advice and understanding of what can and cannot be funded under each category. I know that we've had to rescind some funds in the past because we've made decisions where groups weren't able to use the funding as presented. So I look for your advice during this and making sure that we as a group are properly categorizing things.
Ms. Deaver, do you want to proceed then with the explanation of this?
So, yeah, looking at some special items and the review of the committee activity and fiscal activity cycles, kind of where we are. As we said, March 8th is the pre-application workshop at 6:30. There we go. I knew it was someplace. And the room is still being determined. As we kind of go through this list, April 19th is open the FY24 CDBG and home RFP. April 28th, the applicant letters of intent are due. May 10th, we'll be closing the FY2024 CDBG and home RFP. Deadline for the proposals is that day. May 17th and May 24th, two HCDC meetings for proposal presentations. And then the 25th, the commissioner ranking portal will open. June 7th, the commissioner rankings are due. And then June 14th, HCDC funding recommendations meeting. And then August 21st, the city council budget hearing. So we'll have plenty of time to go through the various stages and provide the whatever training you're interested in receiving that we can get for you.
Ms. Ritter, the addition of the applicant letters of intent was to help the organizations understand what potential category of funding they would fall into and their eligibility criteria. I think to help answer your question on how the city staff can help the organization understand how to prioritize their requests and what additional information. Is that correct?
As I understand it, yes.
Okay. So we should not have, to answer your question earlier, we should not have organizations that are not prepared to spend or use the funding in the funding year, even come to this May 10th closing after you've reviewed those letters of intent. Okay.
Correct.
Diane Schuler. I wanted to share a couple of things that the Human Services Commission does when we review applicants for human service funding. And one of them is site visits, where we actually go and to the sites and visit with applicants, and they show us their operations, and we get a chance to really see what takes place as opposed to only being acquainted with an agency on paper. And that's probably one of the most worthwhile parts of that process. And it's usually one or two of the commissioners who will go, since it's hard to get everybody to go, but they become the eyes and ears of the commission. So I just thought I would toss that out as a possibility. And along with that, a few years ago, some of you that have been on the commission as long as I have, much longer than I have, I remember when we would actually go and visit some of the projects. And again, I think it helps bring it to life for us, gives us a little bit better perspective.
Bus tour.
And picnic at some park.
Yeah, this is Jennifer Deaver. I do, we have been spending, since I started, we've spent quite a bit of time meeting with all of our different recipients. I think now we've gone through the entire list. And so it's been very eye-opening to them, to us, to have casual conversations about what they're doing, getting to know each other, making sure they know who to contact if they have questions, where they are with their projects, things like that. So that's been very informative. I agree with you.
There's something next then, Mr. Deaver, you covered with related to this, or we launch review of the funding cycle in fiscal.
We're kind of combining in that CDBG the funding, which with what we just talked about. Where we're moving to next would be our annual rating criteria review.
Okay. Do we have that? Does anybody have any questions on funding cycles? Yes,
I do. I want to clear what you're. I want to clear up what I heard. So this applicant letter of intent, and then you mentioned that we shouldn't have anybody come in here that would not qualify. So I'm just. How do we? So they would have to come. Where would they come to find out? Is that a special, is that part of the workshop where they come and find out what the letter of intent?
Correct. The March 8th, the pre-application workshop will be where we'll educate on all the things that the programs can do, what they can do with their funds, what the steps are to doing them, when they would need to do those by. It's a very encompassing workshop, so we'll be going through all that kind of information for them.
Okay. So, and are these only the people that you have on your list, sir? Is that what you call it?
This is anybody who would be interested in doing something. I would encourage anyone that was interested in any of the funds to attend and on any, whatever level they're interested on. So you all are welcome to attend. They can attend. It's welcome to everybody.
This is Tom Rose again. I think we as commission members, if we know organizations that we're concerned or aren't getting that information, trying to let those organizations know. Mm-hmm. That's the way they know about it, is getting the word out. That's why we have the survey, the same individuals, it seems like, year after year that are coming forward for funding. They certainly know about it. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Any other questions about that? Okay. Now we're going to look at the annual rating review. Yeah, copy of that. Criteria. Let me put this timer. Let me step back in. Make sure nobody had any questions. We did have a document that was the authorizing ordinance. Did anybody have any questions on that document? Something that was interesting to me, or anything that. Yes. All right. Then we'll go ahead and move on to discussion of the annual rating criteria review. We have a copy of that before us here, and we also have a copy. That was the criteria that the staff uses in rating different applicants, and then criteria that we have developed and used and worked on to try to make things more feasible and useful for us to try to rate as effectively as we can on these different projects and applications. anybody have any comments or concerns or changes? Ms. Jefferson.
I just want to do, I think I've heard a couple different ways about how this does affect or does it not affect how the allegations will be given.
Tim Teddy responding. It gives you a basis to have a starting point. I would say the way I describe point ratings is it expresses to you how not only you as an individual, but how your peers on the commission have rated these applications, so you know their relative strengths, not only in your own eyes, but in the eyes of your colleagues. And that serves as a starting point. We did not set up the point system to be automatic, where if you score above a certain level or where the highest scoring applications automatically get funded, you still have some amount of discretion. And this is a common technique that's used with grants. I've used it in transportation where I've been on a panel that has rated and ranked grant projects that other jurisdictions have submitted to MoDOT. And the facilitator's always explained, it's a starting point for you, but don't feel you have to rank them highest to lowest and then just simply establish a cutoff. You can discuss other reasons you might want to fund a project that perhaps didn't score quite as high. But it does give you, I think, a good starting point. And when we formulate the spreadsheet to show you the results of your ratings, you know, that's how we'll show a proposed distribution of the funding. I think we did that last time. We just went purely on the numbers ourselves. But you do have some discretion. Did that answer your question?
Okay. Well enough, yes.
Okay.
And then we also have, or we're looking at the different projects and the different subsets that they fall under certain percentages that has been predetermined that we try to fit in for those funding. So can you explain that again a little bit more?
Sure. Yeah, since we have four categories that we put projects in, I think that's what I might have been reaching for in my explanation, is you might find that going purely by rank, you then are underfunding a particular category that our policy considers very important. And so you could elevate that lower scoring application, provided it's still a good application. You're not obligated to fund something that is simply missing the mark, but you could elevate a relatively lower scoring application for the purpose of rounding out that funding category because your spreadsheet shows that it's relatively underfunded.
Ms. Thomas, can you explain to me how the percentages will determine or agreed upon? And I know there's a ranking machine.
Yeah, and I'd have to go back to the beginning because this has been done over quite a number of years, and generally on about a five-year cycle, the percentages have been revised. I can recall in my time here where the commission, and it might have been one or two of you that are still on the commission, said, why don't we make these a little more flexible, because we had tighter ranges at one time. I think there were just 10 or 20% bands, and you wanted them to overlap so you had a little more flexibility in between categories. But, yeah, there's, I'm looking for the percentage. Oh, they're not on the spreadsheet. Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't have my policy resolution with me, but I know affordable housing was weighted fairly high. Part of that's because we have city housing programs that we run out of the housing programs division, but part of that is there's also a great deal of interest in addressing preservation and supply of affordable housing by organizations that are capable of doing that. And then the economic and workforce development is relatively slim as a category. I think that might top out at 15%. Part of that is because it's a public service activity. It's training, it's mentoring, coaching. It's something that doesn't produce something, well, it's investment in people most certainly. So it does have lasting benefits. But in the eyes of our federal oversight, HUD, we're not to provide more than 15% of the overall grant to public service activities. In fact, it's a hard cap on how much we can allocate in that category. So that's a reason that that is a slimmer category. A second reason it's economic and workforce development is a number of years ago, on the social services side, the manager approached our housing programs manager about having some agreement that those public service activities that are not economic development would be encouraged to go to the Social Services Commission, the one that Nasular serves on. And that way we'd be assured that the strongest and most meritorious of those applications would be getting looked at by a single commission, and there wouldn't be organizations that would not get funded in that process coming over to our process. So that's another historical reason why that category has been reduced to economic development and workforce activity.
So, Tom or Skinsby, you know, and I don't know if things may be changing with HUD and how you guys, you get that information down. Just in reference to the webinar that Ms. Jefferson had indicated to us, and then also I sent out this article about that, well, the whole, all the federal agencies and about resiliency and climate change and things like that, how some of those might be changing as it comes down. But so, is what they're looking for, different categories of spending.
Yeah, and I think that'll be something we want to reopen with the next five-year plan, mm-hmm. is look at, are there altogether different priorities that we want to put out there for the public to comment on? And I know there's a lot of grassroots movement and also movement of associations that lobby for the Housing and Urban Development Agency to do things a little differently. So we can also monitor that activity to see what kinds of pushes there are toward the federal level to change the program.
Other questions or comments? Were there any questions, recommendations concerning the annual rating criteria?
Diane Schuler, I guess I don't know whether this comment fits in here or whether it should have gone someplace else some other time, but I think one of the issues I always deal with when I go through these is, you know, first of all, the budgets that are submitted by the agencies are really minimalist at best, and tell you nothing about how a lot of the money is going to be spent. It's very broad categories. And so then I think when you're trying to weigh different proposals, it's very difficult to do when you don't have a lot of the detail about how funds are going to be used. And then also outcomes, you know, how do we compare building one affordable house versus training so many people or providing grant assistance. You know, it's like comparing apples and oranges and grapefruit. You know, you just, so I guess I always wonder how we should, you know, how do you do this? Or the outcomes, do we have any history that tells us how good the outcomes were for money that was given to an agency the past year? Did they use it wisely, poorly? You know, how might that inform a decision that's coming? So I struggle often to even come up with ratings because of that, not having a lot of that information.
Yeah, part of my plan is, and this will be in the training that we do, is to ask the groups to be more specific about what types of things they're wanting to do. I have found out that when I was writing agreements that there was some kind of going back and saying, what exactly were you meaning and what, you know. So I think that those are things that can be improved when we get the applications, that they can be a little bit more specific to the one thing that they're wanting this for. And how can we help them get that?
Yes.
Rebecca Shaw, is that part of the discussion in that workshop too, the budgeting? Saying like, you don't need a line item for everything.
Right.
But if there is, I think there was an application last year where there was part of the money to knock down the house and part of it to develop the land and part of the money to actually build. So if things like that separated out for us, that would make things easier.
Absolutely. That is one of the things that I'm planning on adding in, yes.
Thank you.
I've also found that.
Todd Rose again. It is helpful on some of those. I noticed that you've given us indications of what they've done in the past, mm-hmm. a little bit how successful there are reasons that they weren't able to fulfill the commitment. I know we certainly hear from commission members, we would like to see a greater variety of people coming forward. Ms. Washington.
What's my name?
Jeffrey is here, Marcy.
Barbara Jefferson. So I almost forgot something. Never mind. Oh no, I do want to know. I know that when you sent us out information about the different organizations, I guess is it a no-no to say how much the organization already has on hand? Financially, there's no way we could know that.
I think you can ask that, yes.
Ms. Ritter, financials are required to be submitted, yes, with the RFP of the organization. So if you remember in last year's discussion, I believe it was Great Circle applied for funding, and their balance sheet was very strong, and I pointed that out as a reason for the scoring criteria. When a company has millions of dollars on a balance sheet, and they're asking for $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 for improvements, those are things we need to consider. So I'd encourage you to review the financial statements of the companies and the composition of their boards and all of those that come through on their RFP document. Because that will tell you how many, you know, free cash, look for cash and investments and assets on the balance sheet.
I don't know if this is a good time to bring this up now or wait to the end. But you know, we had an applicant that came in. We had a presenter who came up to us and talked about, you know, the things that they were going to do and the amount of money they need. But then, they turned around and did a withdrawal letter saying that they had other ways of making things meet, so to speak. So how often does that happen?
We have
Child Point, and they had received a significant infusion from a statewide or federal other grant, so they just voluntarily removed their application, which freed up the money for CNCA's women's business under that category. So that's happened. I mean, I've been on the commission a long time. It's probably happened less than five times that they received, you know, another infusion of money and willing to pull their application.
Yes.
This is Jennifer Deaver. One thing to remember, and this is something that I think is challenging for people that are applying for different groups that we work with, the CDBG and the home funds are very rule driven by HUD. So there are very specific things that some people want us to do, or, oh, could we do that? Or we're going to do this, we're going to do that. We have to go back. Part of what the staff we do is we review those and look to make sure that those fall within the ramifications and the guidelines set up to us by HUD. It's not easy to get around those. They're very specific. So that's one of the things that we do with our part of the criteria and with our, and with that will also be part of the education day is if the education program we're going to do is to make sure that everybody is aware of that. It's not easy money. It's restricted money by the feds. So we want to make sure that we're handling that in the best that we can to the community and the best that we can to the people that are interested in and offering projects to do.
Any other questions related to that? Okay, I'd like to move on to general comments, and I don't see anybody from the public here today. So I would open up to, and this where I would like to have any comments that any member would like to have questions answered, if they would like at this point in time. Ms. Jefferson.
Barbara Jefferson. So I've heard of when some of the people would come to give a presentation, they would mention tax credit. So tell me, how does that, how does that help? Or
Tim Teddy, one form of tax credit is low income housing tax credit. So those applicants that are involved in a rental production activity mean they're going to build apartments for lower income occupants, they go to the Missouri Housing Development Commission and they apply for low income housing tax credits, which are actually purchased by investors, so they get additional capital to do their project. And depending on whether it's what they call 4% tax credits or 9%, they may get quite a bit of funding for their project. So that's an additional source of funds. CHA's been doing it recently. The various Jeff Smith companies have been doing it, and Gentry Place, Bethel Place, and the latest one on Southampton, Housing for the Elderly. Those are low-income housing tax credit funded. Also, some apartments and townhomes on Hanover were funded by tax credits. I mentioned the CHA. We have an applicant that I believe did not get tax credits in the last round, but there's a planned apartment project by Battle High School called Spartan Point. They've been an applicant for tax credits, so I would expect they'll try again, because that's what often happens is it takes several years of application sometimes to be awarded these tax credits.
Mike Fletcher, so the tax credit is essentially handed out by that commission. It is a voucher, so to speak, for a tax credit, and then the organization that gets that voucher then sells it, and that's how they generate the revenue for their project. Is that correct?
Yeah, and the 4 or 9% refers to the percentage of the projects. I think it's either the basis or the adjusted basis, which is a valuation of the project. And I think they get it for 10 years, so that's quite a bit of money if you talk about 9% of the value of your project for 10 years.
And
it's a very technical process.
And Tim's right. It's a very, very competitive process to get through that. And people do apply for multiple years in a row before they're ever even considered. There was one point when I know that they were even saying that, like, your first few years, it was very hard to get the tax credits because they were so lucrative to get. They're great projects.
Yes, Ms.
Jefferson. Yes. Earlier, when you were talking about Barbara Jefferson, Ward 1, over here. So earlier, when you were talking about what you had received for us results on your on the survey that just went out. And you had mentioned, about how you had, there were like one of your high rank in our ratings had to do with stormwater and I think it was like rebuilding homes or rehabbing homes. So I'm just, how do you, if we have presenters who come here only about housing, then who would you give that money to if, according to the survey, people are saying that they want to know more about the stormwater or rebuilding the home? How do you put that person here?
Tim Teddy, in the case of stormwater, we have a stormwater utility, so if we had a very strong survey result where that was considered by the public or you all as something that would be a high priority for neighborhood revitalization, we'd probably talk to our stormwater utility about that, and we could look at unfunded capital projects. They have a great deal of needs in stormwater because it's a utility, it relies on the revenue from the stormwater charges, which are actually fairly minimal charges. Since stormwater is not something you consume like power or water. And so they do have a great deal of needs, but they would be the applicant then. And the one that we did was over in the Garth Sexton area where we did use some block grant money for that. Historically, I know past city managers have not favored stormwater, but there's been a change in that thinking in recent years. But years ago, it used to be just surface infrastructure because it's more visible. People see a street's been resurfaced and they can see the result more immediately. But I think people become very educated about the importance of stormwater. And after all, it's flood control too. So you get a very, you get a very real benefit if you're on the wrong side of that that flooding. So, yeah. And then on the building rehabilitation, it could be an agency or it could be the city's program.
Much better. I also think in reviewing housing rehab organizations that they pay attention when they're, you know, when we see their proposals to either build affordable housing or rehab affordable housing, which is the main city program, that they consider stormwater improvements and making sure that, you know, drainage and those things are addressed when those jobs are completed. And sitting on the loan and grant committee, I can confirm from that work that the city does enforce those, because we've had water and crawl spaces and basements that they apply for rehab money, and then those, you know, stormwater issues are dealt with all the way from the crawl space out to the street, for example. Another way that we can address, I believe people are answering that survey from maybe a personal homeowner position or renter position, not like, you know, there's a major storm and I have to drive through a deep puddle on Broadway. You know, I think they're answering those questions on the survey from the standpoint of, when it rains really hard, my backyard is flooded, type of situation. So we have to be careful to kind of separate that. And, you know, maybe that should have been maybe a little bit more clear in the wording on the survey. But I was kind of surprised already to see after 120 responses, that's ranking pretty high. Typically, over the course of the entire survey, that will probably fall off and be ranked lower. But that's something that we could address with individual applicants on how they do their site plans and their, you know, architectural work on the projects to address that.
I just want to bring up, I did send out the information about the crime intervention, and I do hope everyone this get a chance to watch that last one that I sent out. That's the one I actually watched on the Zoom for 2 hours, but even the first R of it really talks about how the money can be used coming from PUD, mm-hmm. And just where would that fall for crime? Is that a community that develop that? Crime, like, if there's some organizations out there that are helping, let's say, people that are released from prison, to keep them from going back to prison, like getting them jobs and doing other things. Would that be getting the job part, would that be like an economic development? Community development, would that the crime intervention part? Where would that fall?
Well, I think, I know we have nonprofits in town that deal with the transition from incarceration, for example, to living in a home. And those organizations could qualify for community facilities funding if they had a physical property need. But as far as the service goes, that would probably be a community service, those that do counseling, that do any manner of services to prepare folks for living and making that adjustment, or alternative sentencing, those kinds of things. So those are probably more of community service activities that we would not fund. But I would say if there was a combination of that with job training, that could be eligible for that line, most certainly.
So HUD has all kinds of funding streams, right? This organization is specific to community development law grant. Mm-hmm. So isn't it possible that the types of funding that he was discussing are separate funding streams to communities, not the community development law grant? Is that possible, or is HUD only do CDBG funds? Because I'm not that familiar with how they get funds out too.
Yeah. Tim Teddy again. There's a separate grant called Emergency Shelter Grant, for example. I don't think it has a strong relationship to this topic, but that'd be another example of a grant program that's separate from CDBG. So yeah, no doubt they are involved in other funding streams.
This time, it was my impression from listening to that talk, watching that, is that some of what HUD funding is being utilized, what they seek to utilize as far as the fight crime is improving housing in heavy crime areas where they feel like that's a portion of what contributes to the crime. So they're active that way.
Mitch Ritter, just to reiterate John's point, every time they talk in open sessions or during their proposals, they always mention the opportunity for prior incarcerated individuals to go through their training program. So that's one, and that's, you know, certainly the Women's Business Center, same way. You know, they can have incarcerated individuals come in and start their own business. They can help with counseling and get those things taken care of. The other one I wanted to remember, Tim, you remember Into Action.
Yes.
Into Action. We funded a house over in Whitegate specifically to provide beds and housing, you know, counseling. They provided their own programming. That organization's still in business. If anybody knows a contact there and you're interested in bringing those incarcerated individuals out of the, out of their situation, you know, as they get released back into the community, Into Action is probably the most focused organization for that in Columbia, and we would encourage them to attend the workshop and then apply for those funding if they have more needs. Now they have to have a desire to go through this process again and get the funding, but that would be one organization I would recommend if that's in your ward to contact them and promote that.
Yes, Ms. Jefferson.
Yes. Barbara Jefferson, Ward 1. So I'm thinking about, there are several grassroots, I guess you would call them, organizations that I have become aware of, I would say within the last month, that really works with ex-prisoners, is what I would call them. So they do, I guess it would be on a smaller scale compared to that, to the interaction people, but they do the same thing. And so they would be eligible for community development type money, maybe?
We could learn more about what they do, make a determination on that, and if, or if they have a physical building need, that might be something eligible.
Rebecca Schaum. So just playing off of what Barbara's asking, I think, I just want to understand. We couldn't actually give any of these funds for the programming that a group like that would do, but if maybe they are providing hotel vouchers for someone who needs a place to stay after they come out of incarceration, or they're providing a halfway house type situation, then we could provide funding for that?
Potentially, yeah. Yeah, I think the only reason I'm hesitant is the hotel voucher. I'm not sure what category that fits under. HUD has said in their trainings that the general rule is unless you see it listed as an eligible activity in their published federal rules, it's the general rule is it's not considered eligible. So we'd have to find something that's really close to those activities that you described. Something that's like transitional housing probably is very close to the mark, though, and I would think that's an eligible activity.
There's things to interject here. So, you know, outside of incarceration, that's one thing. For the transitional housing, I do think there would be a problem with hotel vouchers in particular. The COVID funding we could use for that, but this was a little different. Same thing with utility assistance. I know we've had applicants, you know, for like, you know, utility short-term assistance things. That's typically not something that housing and community development gets involved in. You know, that's short-term needs. There are organizations out there that can help with that. These are for longer-term projects for community support. The other thing I wanted to point out was the rigor around, I think, you know, city staff was getting to this, the sophistication of the systems and the bookkeeping and the compliance that an organization needs to follow to get these funds. And I think we've kind of generally mentioned that, but in my 15 plus years on this commission, that always becomes a high priority for me because we've seen so many organizations sit on this money for a year and 2 years because they just can't get the systems in place or the people and the staff to monitor to extend the funds. So it's always the sophistication of an organization, and that's hard for grassroots. I'm going to admit it's hard for somebody who's just started their 501c3 and wants immediate funding in year one. But it's possible. It's just probably not going to get a high ranking for me just because it's, you know, we have so many other programs that can expend that money on a timely basis and have the systems to do the data and reporting. So I think you were next.
I just wanted to clarify that any organization has to have a 501c3 in hand in order to apply for funding. Is that correct?
No. Staff or not, no problem. Yeah.
Correct.
So, Barbara Jefferson, Ward 1, and the groups that I'm talking about, they have had. They've been up and running for three years or more. So it's just unfortunate that they have not become aware of this board. I'm glad to hear that I can spread the word about them. It won't be a waste of their time if they choose to come.
One other thing to keep in mind in many of the trainings that I've been going through is regarding the HUD funds is the CDBG funds are really looked at as a last fund in, not the first funds in. So when organizations are kind of looking at what they need to do, if they're thinking a project may take 5 years, then we're probably, they probably want to wait to come to us towards the end of their project, because we have timeliness tests that we have to meet. And if they don't do that, then that is a bad review on us. So we want to make sure that when we're giving these monies away, that these groups are ready, as we've talked about, to spend the funds during this time cycle and be done.
So to staff, do you actually sit down and tell the applicant, or these are the steps that you will have to take, this is the expectation? Are you going to have the money up front? Is that part of it or not? I don't know. Isn't it? They have to have the money kind of up front from the bank or someplace.
That is part of the training that they receive, yes. So they are aware of that. And it is a challenge. This is, you know, this is part of our charge, is balancing the information we're receiving from the community on the survey on what the community wants and what the community wants the funds used for. And then the same balance goes with what the HUD funds can be spent for. And then on top of that, who applies and who's ready to go. If somebody's not really ready to go, then we don't want necessarily to give them the funds to sit on for a year and then not be able to help somebody else that may have been ready to go. So it is, and that's part of our charge as a group, is to be the very best stewards of the funds we can. And there's lots of factors to take into effect. It's not one thing that you can just pick and say, that's who we're funding. There's several things like that, so.
My last question.
No, you're good.
I promise. Barbara Jefferson, Ward 1. So I guess this is probably something that will have to come maybe towards the end of the year, but the outreach part for knowledge for the community about this board. I like the way that Diane, I think your board had the meeting at the library where we informed the public, this is what we do, this is how we, you know. So has that ever happened for this board commission? Public outreach, like, let's go to the library, or the other one I attended was up there at the Army. To say, yes, we're here and this is what we do.
Are we thinking of an open house type meeting where people would just come in and you'd talk about your roles? That kind of thing. I don't know that we've done something just like those sessions at the library, but I think we've had work sessions. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, please.
Jay Ramonke, city staff. During the 5-year consolidated plan, we met several places. We went to the Arc. We had one at Wolf's Boulevard Church. Boys and Girls Club. So we usually do those kind of things in the 5-year plan, reach out to everybody, make sure all the community can speak at different parts of Columbia. So yes, we have done that.
And I was aware of those sessions. I was thinking of one-off type events, not part of the plan.
Well, I heard you mention locations, and I'm just saying, well, that's all Ward 1, but our targeted populations are like 1, 2, and 3 are the areas. Do you go to those? Do you have locations also that you go in those wards?
Well, I mean, that was during the 5-year consolidated plan. I thought you were asking if we had had meetings in the public besides here, and my answer was yes, we had those places.
Have you had meetings at other wards like that?
Not that I recall, but I've only been here 7 years and we've done one consolidated plan, so I wasn't here for the other one.
And this is Jennifer Deaver, and those are definitely things that we can take into consideration as we move into the next plan as to where we want and to be more, you know, as I said, one of the things I've been excited about with the survey is there's been representation from all over the city, and so we can make sure that we do that too.
I'll just add very quickly, when the city did its previous strategic plan, there were neighborhood meetings in Ward 2 and Ward 3 as well.
Any other questions or comments?
General comment?
Yes.
I think based on the, you know, good overview we had up to this point, but also maybe needing, looks like we're going to meet on March 15th to be the next meeting, which is a ways out. But I think having a summary of the 2022 fiscal year and 2023 fiscal year approved projects by row, showing what we approved and then what has been expended up to this point for each project, would help us have that visual or the knowledge going into this funding cycle to answer those questions about what organizations are effectively expending the funds. So just take the, you know, take PDFs or Excel sheets that we approve the funding off of, add a column for year-to-date expenditures, and then we'll have that difference for 2022 and 2023, since 2022 is still rolling out. 21 due? 2021 probably still has funds too, right?
So 2021 ran January of last year through December 31st of this year. We're writing agreements currently for 2022, so those won't have anything expended. 2023 comes a lot later this year.
So I was a year ahead. Okay.
Yeah.
2023 starts paying out later this year.
Yes, and this annual process will be 2024.
I'll edit my request. Please prepare an update for 2021 fiscal year and 2020.
We have all those spreadsheets, so we could probably email those to you tomorrow.
Just for discussion at the next meeting is fine. I just think for everybody to see and discuss.
That does become confusing, especially to the public. I talked to some town reps speaking today about when I was talking about reviewing the funding cycles, that's what I meant. They said, okay, everybody's got to know what a fiscal year is, you know, but how those funds come and go and cycle through. And we really got thrown a curve with the COVID funds that were different levels of COVID funds that came out and changed other things. So, because that's when we started seeing a lot of support for services that we don't usually do with these CDBG and home funds. Can you do a summary again for me, what can we use for home and what can we use for CDBG? Because sometimes there seems to be an overlap that is confusing. I'm going to go ahead and give you your summary, and then I'll tell you if I know it.
So your question was, what can home funds be used for?
And then what's CDBG?
So if you think of home as putting someone in a home, whether it's building a home or putting someone in permanent housing, that's generally what home funds can be used for.
And so your example of those projects would be?
So like when we use CHOTO funds, those are home funds dedicated to a community housing development organization to put somebody in a new home, so they will build build a home, and then there's timelines on when those homes have to be built, when people get those funds, so they can, for a CHOTO, for example, they would have a year to build a house and then 9 months to sell it. So
the home funds would be pretty limited to the organizations that we're going to see come.
Correct.
For that.
Yes, home funds are very strict in what you can use them for. Now, CDBG, you can use them for infrastructure. So think infrastructure when there's 15% of those funds available for
public services.
Any other questions? Yes, you should.
Maybe kind of following up on that, is there any way to see a little bit of the dynamic of how these funds have been used over time to see what has been the increase in stock of affordable homes or of stormwater systems or whatever? I guess when we had some of the public meetings and all of the agencies came, I think, to our last meeting, and trying to get some estimate of the need and what's been done, I just, you know, it it's every year where we need this, we need this, but, you know, are we moving towards a target, or, you know, what sort of progress are we making, or are we at least treading water? So just some way that we can measure what's been done in the past and kind of what's, where the needs still are.
This is Jennifer Deaver. I yes, we can do that, and I think that that's also what the needs survey is trying to capture, is what people feel the needs are. So yeah, we can, along with having the 20 and 21, we can also put in there and try to see, you know, where those were, how many were actually successful in doing what they were going to do.
I would add to that, Diane, this is Rebecca Shaw. The presentation that Randy Cole gave to the Coalition to End Homelessness, I think, had a most recent report from the Columbia Realtors about how many houses were available, how many rentals were available, and then he actually had a graph that showed kind of the housing stagnation that we saw over the last several years and how we're starting to see enough. It might be worthwhile to ask Randy to share that presentation with us.
We can reach out to him, definitely.
Was there, Tom Gross here, was there, I know a year or two ago I went to a evening presentation that I thought was from Affordable Housing Commission, or was it a task force or something that was fine? And then somebody came in and talked about certain developments that I think people were unhappy about when he came and talked about. Exactly. Was there a task force?
There's a Fair Housing Task Force.
There's a Fair Housing Task Force. That's what could have been. There was an Affordable Housing.
Dr. Rose?
Yes.
Was that at the atrium?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, that was Tony Perez. He was invited under the auspices of the Fair Housing, or the Fair Housing Task Force, and he gave a presentation on what was called the missing middle.
Yes.
Housing.
Yes, and a lot of
there was some interesting dialogue.
Well, this isn't, we can't afford this, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's what I recall. I know, you know, I hear time to get, well, Darren Priest from CMCCA said, well, I think in our last meeting, they were talking about the housing needs, and there's just no affordable housing going up there. No landowners or builders that are getting incentives to build those. I don't know how we change that atmosphere or whatever, but what the city can do to change that, how they can use all these ARPA funds to do anything different for that. So, any other questions, comments? Okay. Very good. Yes, we always like people to voice their questions, comments, so we can be clear on things. They can certainly be confusing. I know we have public that sometimes are confusing. If we think we're confused, we're on the commission, just they can talk about public thinking the past. So that's why we get no press, because the press can't figure it out either. I think at the time. All right. Our next meeting will be on March 15th. Certainly, those who would like can attend the pre-application workshop, and please invite organizations to do that. I will invite into action. I don't think they can use their funds for me to take care of the dollars. We do. And then on March 15th, we'll have the report, the paper report, and update on projects. I would entertain that. A motion to adjourn.
I motion to adjourn.
All in favor? Thank you all very much.